you very much. This is the new one. Keepers of Time. From rough, serrated mountain peaks, above the clouds that touch the sky, down to the bathtub smoothened by the sea, the rugged rocks are keepers of our time. Magnetic magma chunks from the deepest core, and chasms, rifts, and canyons, carmine lava sores, all liquid time afloat since our planet's birth. Condensed to rocky layers in the earth, embedded shells and fossils tell of days gone by. Crystal veins run through the fissured grounds, sediments of molten sand and stones trickling through the jagged face of cliffs, sparking up imaginations of the humankind. Time has set to diamonds, gems, and gold. The pebbles, aeons pressed and licked away, gravels grit her grounded splints of time, like sifted sand adrift in heavy shifts, crumbled down and blown by wind to dunes, compacted and compressed again by tides. They are the concretion of time evermore, the highest ridges with their cragged crests, or the ice-grey granite blocks of glacial drifts, the even flint stones in the bedrock of rivers, and the pebbled rubble washed onto the shore. Stardust glimmers on the sandy seaside, boulders of meteorites land a piece from space, a universal message for the minders of Earth. Stones are the keepers of our time.
Thank you, that was gorgeous. Next, Jen Matthews.
So I'm a Yank and I come from Missouri, and our state motto is called Show Me State. And there's some really old reason for that, kind of a political reason, and it was kind of meant as an insult, but it got turned into this thing where we're like really proud to be the Show Me State. So the reason I'm telling you that is I use that as part of the poem. Right. So I'm from St. Louis, which was featured a few years ago by Ross Kemp on Gangs. So he went to Afghanistan, and then he went to East St. Louis, right? Okay. This is called Gateway City. Show me a city gridded on gentrification. Show me a clogged artery of a river, sister to fault line and limbo for lost souls, catfish, broken wagon trains, drowned slaves, suicidal blues singers. Show me the green breast of the West, and I'll turn from it. I'll settle on settling. Show me the salmon of knowledge, and I'll fry the river fish of forgetting instead. Show me the ancient civilization highway rest stop. I'll climb on top and look out to where the static riverboats are moored to a loophole. Casinos, not history. Hamburgers, not twain. Straddling us all, a polished arch, the symbol that promises opportunity elsewhere. This way out, this way through. Don't look up. Thanks.
Next we have Anish Shukla.
Okay, so last year I lost a very dear friend of mine to cancer, and she was way too young to go, and a few weeks after that I wrote this for her. It's called Celebration of Life. Which blossom is most beautiful, I ask? The one that blooms latest, they say. But what if this truth wears a mask? Can't the wind blow that blossom away? I gaze upon the distant horizon's red, and I'm reminded of my youngest friend. The blossom that bloomed last is dead, and my friend has met her dreary end. She knew more of me than she should. She believed in truth, honor, and love. I'd soar to where she's reached if I could. Oh, had I the wings of a dove. But for such a free spirit of this world, I do not passively mourn her death. For my world, a new life she unfurled, remaining pure until the last breath. And so instead, I celebrate her life. I know she'd prefer it that way too. She always advised me against strife, and to live each day born in you. Thank you.
Pavlova. I don't resent you for moving on with your life, or even for moving on with him, of all people, whoever he is. This isn't anger, but disappointment. That was our place. How could you take him there? Treat its personal history in your heart as nothing, as trash. How could you lean over the table and kiss him that way? Laugh at his jokes, smile nervously, there of all places. Share the pavlova as if now, to either of us, the pavlova could ever possibly be just a pavlova once more. How could you take him there, of all places? That girl I was with was just a friend. It isn't the same. And we had separate pavlova. Thank you.
Next we have Eugene Crowley.
Martyr, in the internet, while still coming, traveling woman, flipped through. Graham Lyder earned his unpresumed limited. Gold rain biscuits, agus te te, to Christian, till and te. In no way, guy, our ulor lendo, till us still sail. I cannot lend of all.
Siblings are forever. Siblings are forever, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, in photographs and hand-me-downs. An unbreakable bond, an irritable resemblance, tight knots in tongues, never to reveal incestuous secrets. Siblings are forever, as uncles and aunts, overlooking the next layer of constant cousins through sepia lenses. They fill the front row seats at funeral auditoriums, side by side, regardless of grudges, to grieve as one, the loss of a parent, a common guardian, a home. A safety net is pulled from under their feet, and they're forced to swim against the tides of torment together. Siblings are forever.
This is a translation from the German of Rainer Maria Rilke, his first sonnet for Orpheus. Oh, how this tree is risking its crisp height, while Orpheus sings in the ear's high bower. And all grew hushed. But even in that hush rose new creations, blinking into light. Beasts from this stillness, drawn out from the bright, unfettered forest, from their dens and lairs, close in together without guile or pain, and softly, with receptive ears, remain. Their ragings, roarings, raspings, ceased in hearts transfixed. Here even barest wattle would resound, a dwelling house from darkest wishes wound. Orpheus makes the gate posts tremble, and from the inner ear constructs his temple.
This is called attach, detach, reattach. I have felt the nurture from you, felt it too good to be true. I have felt the pain and void in your absence, felt the look, felt the lack of air when you fill a room. I have felt the lack of knowing what I need to self-soothe, felt repeatedly forced milk beyond purpose of comfort or food. I have felt the implosion of my own substance, felt it was a necessary sacrifice in order to maintain you. I have felt all I can do but push away, felt the stretching of my legs in order to create my own space. I have felt my heart hardening to keep its chambers from invasion, felt my foundations retreat and begin to regroup. I have felt nothing more than love hate for you. I have felt I can only live myself by cutting the cord and letting it wither and die away from me.
First day in new job. Good morning and welcome to Dynan Global. I'm John. Okay guys, so you've had a chance to see a little of the building. Our facility here spans many miles, has many hundreds of discrete zones. It seemed a little daunting to me too when I started here at the Holt. Remember, your orientation pack contains a detailed floor plan. You all got your OPACs from induction, right? Think of the server levels as the building's heart and brain. Our machines use more electricity than the 8 greatest cities in Asia. They seem silent, but the noise just kind of seeps right into you. You can almost hear it afterwards in your quarters. They remember everything. They remember everything. Emails and credit checks, CAT scans, synaptic maps, tag photographs, the whole world's movie tickets and restaurant bills, everyone's autobiography. Guys, I have walked in that infinite library, and my report is a matter of record. I travelled till my feet bloodied and toughened were stumps. Further it seemed than any 6 men could walk in 6 lifetimes, seeing no one. All those parallel stacks, neatly filled with identically grey-bound volumes, some fat, some unthinkably thin, each with somebody's name on the spine. I do not recall sustenance, but provision of some kind there must have been. After a time, the tan, hard-wearing carpet gave way to some kind of laminate. Then the carpet started again. I did not sleep. I faded away, as they say, to nothing. But enough about me. We live in a world that holds not only greater prospects, but greater threats than we've ever known. I need names. We need to know who is or may become a threat to our security. Confidence, safekeeping, certainly we have grandiose aspirations here at DGI. In a few minutes, I'll give you the grand tour of your workstations. Here at Dynan Global, you'll be part of a team. The equations we create together will wander the library's aisles like busy ghosts. Will sort the volumes for us. These mathematics are our weapons, our guardians, our hope. You all with me so far?
Stop taking. Our hearts Western are built for bliss, rather the ridicule of those we love, or the stark quality of what we are not, to be guardians of our own making. Kissing the long arm of a private law, blotted out by acres of Chardonnay. Among other things, why should I be contrite? Why should I be the one to turn off the light, crawling on the bed to do so? The night is always cold regardless, how the stars and our hearts go awry. Ignorance is no longer a sin nor a defence, as we long to see ourselves go for the comfort of our own homes. Or the quality of stars in our minds, the structure supported by complacency. Why should I be contrite for this?
And I've been here, this is my third week in a row here, and I have to go home and be a yank on Friday. And I'm here with students, and we've had the loveliest time. But I think the first time I was here, I read a poem that ended something like, be kind, Cork, be kind. Thank you for being kind. I have a special dispensation to read a short story. I published a book last year. It's a small book. There are no copies of it, but this one in Ireland. And I'm hoping to leave it here, so if you're interested, make an offer. I'm thinking a pint would do it. This is called The Aborted Documentary, and it's this short. A static-filled screen flashes to a headshot of a mother seated on a maroon and gold ottoman. Medium plump, with tightly permed curls and oversized bifocals, she wears a pink sweatshirt under a green and red checked apron. Her face features the prominent lower lip and cocked eyebrow of a matron coerced by her progeny into sitting before a video camera. The filmmaker's voice, resolute and quasi-formal, addresses her from off-camera. Ready? Her eyes widen with dread, and she shrugs her shoulders. Here's the deal, Mom. Talk to me as if I died last week. You've got 2 minutes. Go. Her eyebrows rumple toward the bridge of her nose. She draws a quick breath, audible over the murmur of a television in another room. Go ahead, her son says. I'm dead. Run with it. She glances into the lens, then at her lap. What do you mean? She asks. I mean, I died last week, and now there's a documentary film crew interviewing you about me. Oh, you and that damn camcorder, she says. Talk about me, Mom, not to me, and could you set down that drink? Jesus Christ, she mutters, and puts her glass on the end table. He was a very good boy. She folds her fingers together in her lap and gazes off toward the kitchen. That's it? That's all you've got? What more do you want? She asks. I don't know, something a bit less boring? Oh, you want interesting? She picks up her drink, downs the last swallow of vermouth, and spins the ice in her glass. I'll give you interesting. Please do. He thought he got away with things. Like what? Oh, believe me, she says, you don't want to know. Sure we do. She raises her chin and glares at the camera. No, you don't. Mom, this project will only work if you tell the truth. So what sorts of things did he think he got away with? This, she says, and waves her cupped hand in the universal gesture for masturbation. That boy kept nudie magazines under his mattress and played with himself 3, 4, 5 times a day, every day, up until the day he died. Mother! He'd do it in his bedroom, or the bathroom, or even in the TV room when he thought no one knew he was watching those sexy movies. All right, stop, enough. After a long pause in which the mother's face spreads into a callous smirk, the filmmaker asks, did he do anything you'll remember him for? She considers this. Not really. Oh, come on, Mom. She shrugs again. Well, he tried acting, music, even writing for the local paper, but he wasn't very good. Not really, not in a way that anyone would take notice. She gives the camera a wink. He was mainly just a kid who never appreciated his mother and shot his wad into bath towels, which She then had to haul from his bedroom and pile into the washing machine. The camera tilts toward the floor where, for a split second, it captures a blurry view of the mother's worn white sneakers and the frayed cuffs of her pant legs. The image shudders into a flurry of black and white snow.
Next up, we have Connor McNabb.
This is a short story called Evening. The sun was dipping behind the corrugated roofs of the jam factory. The 10-6 bus from Sligo had dropped off a roll of evening newspapers and an engine part for Gilday's garage. And I was lying on the white line in the middle of Low Street, looking up at the pale blue sky and waiting for cars. The road was warm. I could smell the tar, and down that close you could see small bubbles of tar that swole and burst. I looked up at Malloy's window. He'd be having the tea. He came home from school and had his dinner in the middle of the day with his father, the bank manager. Bank managers and their families could have the dinner in the middle of the day. I followed the telephone wires from pole to pole and thought of September when the swallows would line up to leave. And I followed a single wire from the pole that ran right overhead to a white fitting under the thatch. Swift swooped from the eaves of the thatch, and I watched as they soared and bickered and soared until they almost disappeared and then plummeted and swooped again. John Healy was closing out the shop doors, and Douglas Croft pulled down his blinds. Cars for Ballinaglair and Arigna had gone through, and it was that quiet time before the dinner when the sound of the ball echoed in the shadows, and I waited for the captain to return, and my mother placed a chair on the footpath to catch the last rays of the sun as it lit up the front of the house and penetrated deep into the bar. She was now preparing the dinner. I watched Miles Flynn go home with his curly hair parted and combed to one side and his blue shirt the colour of the summer sky. He had the neck of his shirt open and the sleeves rolled back from his wrists. He walked with his hands in his pockets and his navy blue V-neck sweater hung through the hoop that his arm made. It was that sort of evening. And then John Joe Gibbons was shouting and standing over me. He looked huge and it was hard to recognise him looking up from my position on the road. John Joe Gibbons wore a hat and oxblood jobber's boots with elasticated sides and a long jobber's mat coat that you wouldn't see dried dung on, and cycled a bike and brought us in carrots. He was in the fire brigade, and when the siren would go off you'd see John Joe coming flying round the Carrick Road corner on his big black man's bike and head up Hill Road to the fire station. Shouting and pulling me by the t-shirt, he pulled me up the steps by the copper beech and in the hall door to my mother and gave out to her for letting me do it, lie on the road. And going out, shouted something about if I was his son and how I was lucky I wasn't. My mother said, "That old bollocks." And I don't know if she meant it or not, but she ran me up the stairs to bed saying she was going to knock the flitting and gadding off me. It was the only time ever I missed dinner, and it was John Joe Gibbons' fault. That evening I had to content myself with looking out the hole in the broken window as I waited for the captain to return in the orange maxi. When the captain did finally arrive back, himself and Tom Flynn were half eaten with midgets, and they had to have a glass of beer each, they were that thirsty. He brought back a set of cram wheels for the go-kart I was going to make, and had a ball of white putty in greaseproof paper he wanted me to soften. The putty was like mala, but it had dried out, and I had to add linseed oil to it and soften it up. It was a job I'd done before. It was a ball the size of a man's fist, and I kept at it, pressing it and rolling it and folding it and flattening out and rolling it up again like a lump of dough until it was smooth and moist and had no hard bits. It was a man's job, and I loved making thumbprints in the putty and smelling the linseed oil off my fingers. As the sun slipped further down behind the jam factory, its warm yellow light lit up the high street and the front of our house and threw crisp rays in the doorway, across the bar floor and up the counter and across the countertop and jumped the glitter off the chrome of the optics and the mirrors behind. Sometimes Mick Coyle stood in the doorway with a flute case in his hand waiting for his brother and the Smithicks. He always waited in our house for his brother and always drank Smithicks when he waited in summer and stout when he waited in winter if he wasn't doing November. And in winter he stood in the drinking room in his grey top coat, under the set of shark's teeth that hung from a nail on the chimney breast, with his back to the fire and his black flute case left on the mantelpiece. He was the only man I knew with a grey top coat. And if the brother was late, trouble with a cow calf, he'd say, he'd have to have another one and might open his coat. And the brother would arrive in a station wagon full of speakers and microphones and drums, and they'd head off to wherever they were playing, Keiju or Ballyfarnham. He played the trumpet and the flute as good as Matt Malloy and could play the tin whistle through his nose. And in the shade of Jimmy's door, Tom Gaffney often stood, who in his black suit and gangster hat waited on his crutches for a lift to a removal or bingo. Top of the house, I know. He'd stand in the doorway of Jimmy's, making small talk with Jimmy and farmers who had the hay saved. Happy farmers with scrubbed, shiny faces and hay seed in the turnips of their trousers and in the cracked creases of their boots, inned by the Observer or a pound of ham and a few tomatoes. And on nice evenings, Paddy Smith, Hackney man, stood at the Carrick Road corner waiting propped with his back to the wall, resting on his metal crutches, half a leg missing, and the black suit trouser neatly folded up and fastened with a safety pin. The missing half itched for weeks after they cut it off, but he didn't give up. He got an automatic that he could drive with one leg and continued as per usual, waiting to bring someone home in his automatic Hackney, or maybe bring someone to a removal or bingo. Top of the house, I know. And often Joe Tansey would drive up Low Street, slowly, with the whole family on board, slowly in his car, shining, immaculate, going for cones and Jimmy's. He'd pull up to Jimmy's and park the car so as he could see the whole way up Low Street and all the way down Mill Hill. And they'd sit there eating their cones, watching. Six pairs of eyes watching everything. And then when they'd finish the cones, he'd drive up and down Low Street a couple of times, even more slowly, before going home again. Joe only lived a couple of hundred yards away from Jimmy's. You could easily send a gob of spit from Jimmy's door to Joe's front door. And at this time of the evening, Tom Gibbons, brother of John Joe's, who, in cap suit and hobnail boots, would cross High Street in three long strides from the top of the steps by the lime tree and in the hall door of Shell House for a pint after he parked the lorry at the jam factory. No doubt to talk about his run to Tuam or the docks in Dublin with a load of jam on, and swap livery stories with Frank Shanley, who was dark and coal dusty and always tied his horse to a telephone pole on Low Street. A big, tired, lumbering horse with stitched leather blinkers eaten from a nose bag after bringing a load of coal from the top of Arigna, while Frank drank whiskey in Shell House. The siren went off. The sound hung in the air. I watched the Carrick Road corner for John Joe Gibbons and hoped he had gotten the whole way home before having to cycle the whole way back in again. Sure enough, he came around the corner. Usually the tails of his jobber's mac would be flying, but he was in his shirt sleeves and hat, humped over the handlebars, pushing the bike on. As I waited in anticipation for the brigade, I imagined the flurry of activity, pulling on boots, hats, cumbersome coats half on. A car sped up Low Street, probably another fireman. And then I heard the engine slowing as it turned for Carrick and the Revy, and the front of her rising as she passed Paddy Smith. He raised a hand off the crutch handle and waved. Blue light flashing, no siren, just the high revving roar of the engine, and I watched as it turned down Mill Hill, heading for Arigna. Tom Gaffney waved. A forest or bog fire high on the mountain. Thank you.
A memory of we. My stout settles while I wait again, and a couple in a far off corner don't speak, while both staring off in the same direction. Today, I said to you, whilst trembling invisibly by your side, any real change has got to hurt, you know, as we have to be as much marble as we are sculptor. And then, before you could speak, you said to me that there is a place where you never have to be afraid again, where you are known, holy, and loved, where rainbows end and mayflies get to live another day, where you will never become what you fear you might, for you write poems of love and hope without ever needing to, where you get to be what you've always been, where you get to give the ocean that you've always had to give, where shooting stars endure and sparks ignite and light is all that there is, even in the dark, where you get to live as you once lived, where you get to be released, where the angel whose eyes you've always felt upon you cries at finally knowing that she had met her task and not failed, where there was a reason for all that you have ever suffered, where it is known that you never give up on good or ever would, where love is king and godlike, where passion is, where when passion is not, you know that it is as sure to return as the sun, where tiny fingers grip your thumb and dismayed despair retreats undone, where love can reign in flesh and bone, where you never have to walk alone, where you've been through pearly gates, where heaven is, where two love waits. Thank you. Thank you.